Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the recent landmark Supreme Court decision on healthcare with Azeez Huq, a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. While liberals are celebrating the Roberts ruling, he argues in an article at The Nation, in the healthcare decision, a hidden threat, that there are idiosyncratic libertarian ideals inserted in the law that could explode into much larger and more harmful doctrines. Then we'll go to London to investigate a series of banking scandals involving muni bond bid rigging that enabled bankers and traders to rob the public to create bonuses for themselves. Economist Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University, joins us to discuss the latest financial scandal that may be the tip of another iceberg the titans of Wall Street are heading for. Then we will go to Oaxaca, Mexico, to speak with Fabian Tepper, an independent journalist who witnessed massive protests in the town square yesterday when students and workers who wanted to vote for the PRD candidate López Obrador were denied ballots. Then finally, we will speak with an official observer who is monitoring the Mexican elections, Pamela Starr, the director of the U.S.-Mexico Network at USC and a former professor of Latin American political economy at the private university ITAM in Mexico City. She has an article at foreignpolicy.com, What Mexico's Election Means for the War on Drugs. Joining us now is Azeez Huq, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. He has an article at The Nation, in the healthcare decision, A Hidden Threat. Welcome to Background Briefing, Azeez Huq.
Hi, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And as I mentioned in the opening, you have this article in which you say that while liberals are celebrating the Roberts ruling, there are idiosyncratic libertarian ideals inserted in the law that could explode into much larger and more harmful doctrines. So elaborate, if you will.
That's absolutely right, Ian. I think it's really important to begin by saying that the law, that the decision last week is a really big victory, not just for Obama, but for the tens of thousands of people who've already been able to access health care and the millions more who will get health care as a consequence of the decision to uphold the law. That's an enormously big deal, and I don't mean to underplay that. When I refer to a hidden threat in the article, what I mean is that there are sections of the court's reasoning that are part of the binding law that will, in the future, impose new constraints upon Congress's ability to pass legislation, programs that are designed to mitigate social risks, and that also imperils presently enacted programs that are meant to provide parts of the social safety net.
Well, you mentioned in your article at The Nation that there is an analogy here or a comparison here with the famous Marbury versus Madison decision of 1803 that lay dormant like a loaded gun for a long time. So tell us about what is dormant in this and what is likely to explode at some time in the future.
Yeah, so in Marbury v. Madison, the Supreme Court with the great early Chief Justice John Marshall writing basically said that it had the power to invalidate federal laws, but it used that power in a way that denied the administration at the time, Thomas Jefferson's administration, the ability to make the court an object of political vilification. Basically, it said we're striking down a law that gives us the power to issue a remedy in this case. Therefore, Thomas Jefferson wins, but in winning, he had to accept the court's ability to strike down laws. And something similar happened in this case, in the sense that the court, and in particular, the part of the opinion that Chief Justice Roberts wrote, that is the legally operative part of the court's judgment, the court upheld the individual mandate, saying that it was authorized as a tax. But Chief Justice Roberts was very careful to say that In so doing, he was imposing constraints on the Commerce Clause, which is an important part of Congress's repertoire of constitutional tools to get things done. And in another part of the opinion that I think has not yet received as much attention as it ought to, he said that the court would uphold the Affordable Care Act's extension of Medicaid, which is a social security type program that is operated largely by the states and works through grants by the federal government to the states. But that as conditions on that grant, the federal government imposes certain requirements and restrictions upon states that are meant to ensure that the really most needy benefit from the money that the federal government gives to the states for Medicaid. The court said it was going to uphold the expansion of Medicaid using that spending power that the Congress has, but that it was imposing a new limit on that spending power. And this is the real core, I think, of what's troubling about the healthcare decisions. The court limited the federal government's power to give money to the states and to impose conditions upon those grants. Congress has used its ability to give money with strings attached over the course of the last 50 years to enact a whole series of really important regulatory safety net type programs. And these range from education programs, so actually No Child Left Behind was a conditional spending program. Many of our civil rights laws are conditional spending programs. So Title IX, which is the law that protects against sex discrimination in education, is conditional spending. And Title VI, which is the law that requires recipients of federal grants to refrain from racial discrimination, is also conditional spending. The court's decision creates a new basis for states and other recipients of federal grants to argue that they have the right to take federal money but not to comply with the federal conditions that come with it. And that really does, if it was aggressively interpreted, and we don't know how it'll be interpreted, but if aggressively interpreted, has the real potential to undermine a lot of important both regulatory anti-discrimination laws and social safety net laws.
Again, I'm speaking with Aziz Haque, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and he has an article at The Nation in the healthcare decision, A Hidden Threat. And specifically, we're talking about the Commerce Clause that is the central plank of congressional authority. It came into being under Roosevelt against tremendous states' rights resistance, and it has become the framework or the enabler of such things as the Environmental Protection Act and a lot of civil rights laws. And what you're arguing here, Aziz Haque, is that the Roberts decision has opened up new limitations on the Commerce Clause that you don't consider, we've seen anything like this until the Republican Party embraced these Tea Party ideas, that, and this could be the seed that could unravel important benefits of the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, well, so I should be clear that there are two important congressional powers at stake. One is the Commerce Clause and the other is the Spending Clause. In the healthcare decision, a majority of the court imposes new limits on both the Commerce Clause and the Spending Clause, and both of those are very important federal grants of authority. The limit on the Commerce Clause is probably going to be not as important for reasons that I can explain if you want. The limit, though, on the Spending Clause, which is the issue that actually nobody really paid attention to as the case was running up, and it was sort of an addendum to the Supreme Court's oral arguments, and it kind of has fallen away in the backdrop. But the court's opinion on the Spending Clause and the limits imposed on the Spending Clause, I think, have a real potential to be disruptive, both of previously enacted laws like Title VI and Title IX, and also, I think it has the real potential to undermine Congress's ability to use its ability to spend to impose important regulatory mandates on the states moving forward.
So what is, you're suggesting that this is a new kind of dormant authority, that if it's pursued aggressively, it could really change the nature of the power of government.
That's right. Congress has always had the ability to collect tax money and to use that tax money by giving it to the states and saying, states, you can take this, but you have to follow the following rules. For example, you can't engage in sex discrimination in a public university. You can't run a classroom that's racially discriminatory. You can't, we're going to give you money for highways, but you have to construct your highways and your transportation system in a way that's environmentally friendly and that comports with the goals of environmental policy. The Supreme Court in the healthcare decision said for the very first time that a condition imposed on spending was unconstitutional because it coerced the state. The court's decision does not have a crisp or clear definition of what it means to coerce a state unconstitutionally. That idea it's kind of floated around in some Supreme Court cases, particularly in the 1930s, but this is the first time that it's been used to invalidate something. And precisely because it's a powerful idea, it's an idea that is very poorly conceptualized, very unclear in this healthcare decision itself, and it's very subjective, right? What it means to be put under pressure that is, unfair somehow is very much in the eye of the beholder. For example, one of the things that Chief Justice Roberts says in the healthcare case is, well, you know, the states here were coerced because they were offered so much money, right? So the coercion comes from the lure of the federal dollars. There were so many federal dollars at stake that they couldn't resist it, right? So that this is a very odd and potentially powerful and disruptive theory that goes to an important federal power, the power to raise money and then to spend it by giving it to states and to impose conditions on those federal grants to states, a power that's been used to create all sorts of important regulatory programs in the civil rights field, in the education field, in the environmental field, and many other areas.
Well, but the idea of coercion as a lure, as though it's some sort of prostitute beckoning you into a dark corridor, it's almost like the Twinkie defense. It has a peculiar, unreal quality to it.
Well, this is right. This is right. The court basically said that the states have become so dependent upon federal money for Medicaid that it would be unconstitutional to deny them that money moving forward. So I presume if, and it's a very odd decision because it suggests that somehow states have an entitlement to whatever money they were getting last year as Medicaid funds into the future, right? And we all know that's not how federal appropriations work. Federal appropriations are done anew every year. We don't know what's going to be the case for, you know, federal appropriations a year, 2 years, 3 years from now. And yet, the court's opinion makes it seem as if there's almost an entitlement on the part of the states.
And these are states, by the way, who have sued to strike down the Affordable Care Act, and they've made a very clear statement that they don't want the federal money. They want nothing to do with the federal government in this regard.
Well, to be fair to the states, what they want is they want the money, but they don't want any of the conditions. They just want cash, and they say, look, we ought to have this cash, and it ought to be for us to decide what to do with it. And this is of course in line with the kind of Paul Ryan plan for block grants to the states in lieu of federal regulatory programs that direct how money is going to be spent.
Well, as I say, it strikes me as a kind of weird dog ate my homework argument. I'm astounded when you explain it to me. Just in closing, though, Aziz Haq, your your former boss that you clerked for, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she noticed this, did she not, in the decision, and put up a very cogent defense.
That's right. And Justice Ginsburg writes in the healthcare decisions an opinion that is for herself and for a number of the other justices that explains both why the court's new limitation on the Commerce Clause and also its new theory of coercion with respect to the Spending Clause are both unmoored. They don't have a basis in previous precedent. And moreover, I think she very sort of nicely points out they're illogical. And she has some very cogent critiques of the internal logic of Chief Justice Roberts's opinions. And it's rather inside baseball, but people who really want to sort of get a handle on kind of what's going on in those opinions, I think the Justice Ginsburg's opinion is a great place to start, although I'm obviously biased.
Well, but I think what you're suggesting here and what people should really pay attention to is that this may be a hollow victory if indeed the Supreme Court justice didn't want to be that radical to strike down a sitting president's signature legislation, at the same time put in a poison pill that may have the same result if it's exploited later.
I don't think it's a hollow victory because I do think that the Affordable Care Act is not going to be invalidated on constitutional grounds, and there are thousands, if not millions, of people who will receive health care as a consequence of this decision who would otherwise not get it. So that I think, is not going to change. What's going to change is sometime in the future, there is the potential for the court, with respect to other laws, to invoke parts of this opinion in ways that compromise the constitutionality of those other laws. So I would expect, for example, to see aggressive attacks by states on laws like Title VI and Title IX, which are conditional funding grants that impose anti-discrimination mandates. I would expect to see those challenges coming down the pike, and I think that the opinion in the healthcare cases lays the groundwork for invalidating or compromising those programs, which I think is a really big deal.
Well, it sounds like a gift to Rand Paul. It's actually quite a disturbing possibility. And I thank you for joining us here today, Aziz Haque.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Aziz Haque, who is a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He is a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. He has an article at The Nation in the healthcare decision, A Hidden Threat. We're going to take a brief station break and then we'll go to London to talk about the latest financial scandal. I've got it all, almost. I've got it all, figured out, but always when I get there, always when I get there, all the pieces, they just fall apart. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now from London is economist Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, who is currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University. She is the author, along with Jose Antonio Campo and Joseph Stiglitz, of Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephanie Griffiths-Jones.
It is always a pleasure to be there.
And the Barclays just paid a monumental settlement, as did the Royal Bank of Scotland, because of manipulation of the LIBOR rate in London. That's the London Interbank Offered Rate. Now, just to give you an idea of the money, Barclays agreed to pay $450 million, $200 million of which to the U.S. Commodities Futures Trading Commission, $160 million to the Criminal Division of the United States Department of Justice, and $93 million to Britain's Financial Services Authority. But my understanding is that they beat UBS to the punch in terms of settling, and this is just the tip of an iceberg.
I think that this has been a very bad week for banks. They've had at least three major problems just in the UK. The first, banks like Royal Bank of Scotland couldn't even get money from one account to another, which delayed payments to lots of households and small and medium enterprises because of some computer problem they had. Then they had a mis-selling of derivatives to small and medium enterprises, which they forced these companies to buy, and when they didn't work out, made major losses, and some of these small companies went bankrupt as a result. And finally, what you're referring to, Barclays and other banks have been fiddling the way they fix one of the key international interest rates, which is the LIBOR. And so this has been really quite an appalling week, which shows again how deeply flawed the financial system is in the UK, but more widely in Europe and in the United States, and how much it desperately needs fixing.
And the Royal Bank of Scotland is about to be fined $233 million. It's also 82% owned by the British taxpayer. What's extraordinary here is that the people who manipulated the LIBOR rate, the traders, in complicity with the banks, they still get their bonuses, but then the taxpayer, the British taxpayer, which is largely the government, ends up having to pay the bill.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's true that when this manipulation was done, this was before Royal Bank of Scotland was effectively taken over by the government, but it still creates a lot of problems for the real economy. It doesn't, for example, lend properly. It hasn't increased lending to small and medium companies. In fact, lending to the private sector by banks like the Royal Bank of Scotland has systematically fallen. So there's a big paradox, because we taxpayers have bailed these people out. We own the bank, particularly in the case of Royal Bank of Scotland, to a lesser degree in the case of Lloyds Bank, and yet we have no authority over how it's run. And as you say, they still keep paying massive bonuses and massive salaries into the top executives. So I think the outrage amongst the average citizens, and even amongst the fairly conservative establishment figures like the governor of the Bank of England, is really growing, because they're both incompetent and greedy. And I think it's this particular mixture that is completely unacceptable to the public. That's why the Labour leader, Ed Miliband, has, I think, rightly called for an overall inquiry, a judicial inquiry, into the financial sector, into the banking sector. But unfortunately, the government does not want to do that and is limiting it more narrowly to just a parliamentary inquiry. But I think it's very important that a major inquiry should be done, like was done in the 30s in the United States with the PECORA Commission, which I think facilitated really good regulation like you had with the Glass-Steagall Act. We really need to reshape the financial sector. It's very interesting, the International Monetary Fund, no radical or liberal institution, has just come out with a very interesting paper arguing that the smaller financial sector may actually be better. So we need smaller, less speculation, more transparent, more accountable, and better run financial sector.
What's at stake here in terms of this manipulation of the LIBOR rate is that essentially the traders, in complicity with the banks, have been robbing the public to create bonuses for bankers by artificially lowering interest rates. The banks cause cities, towns, counties, and other public entities to receive smaller returns on their variable rate investment holdings. That's what's going on here, right?
Exactly. And they sacrifice normal average citizens' earnings for getting exorbitant benefits for the bank, and, as you say, massive bonuses for themselves.
So,
and they explicitly say this, you know, they pay themselves with bottles of champagne. I mean, it is just so gross. It's like a caricature of bad banking and trading practices which has emerged.
So this muni bond bid rigging came out in a trial in Manhattan, the Corallo bid rigging case, which has been in a Manhattan courtroom, and obviously the fines have just come down. But there's clearly got to be a Wall Street connection here. I mean, so much of what has gone on Wall Street going back to 2008, more recently with J.P. Morgan Chase losing initially $2 billion and now it's up to about $9 billion in bad trades, were all done through London affiliates. So just my antenna goes up here, Stephanie Griffith-Jones, to assume that there's also a Wall Street dimension to this story.
You're quite right. I mean, in this, it wasn't just British banks involved. It's 16 international banks that fixed LIBOR. And so I'm sure that American banks are involved. And as you say, the problems that J.P. Morgan had, which are leading to these massive losses based on speculation in derivatives, was actually done through their London offices. So not only do we need good regulation in the United States, in the United Kingdom, but we also need good global regulation because we need to cover all the grounds. Because if not, the bankers would just game the system, would just exercise regulatory arbitrage and go for the country or the financial center where regulation is weakest. And we must just stop all this because it is unacceptable. These banks are so powerful. We have to remember that in the United States, 40% of corporate profits are made in the financial sector. I mean, this is unacceptable. It's a sector that doesn't actually produce anything except headaches for all the rest of us, and they grab 40% of the profits. So there are these linkages, as you say, and these linkages reinforce the high bonuses and the high salaries which they pay themselves.
But it's absolutely incomprehensible, Stephanie Griffith-Jones, that and it's not surprising, but it's incomprehensible that the Conservative government in the United Kingdom would say that we really can't do anything about this and they don't feel there's a need for an inquiry because they're not even sure that what's happened against the law. This is the ultimate definition of insider trading, where traders can call up these bankers and basically order them to lower and manipulate the interest rates on derivatives. I mean, some of this stuff was in the court case came from intercepts, you know, from phone taps. And you can read the conversations, you know, trader, can you please continue to go in for 3 million LIBOR at 5.365 or lower? We are very long cash here in New York. The LIBOR rate submitter, how long? Trader, until the effective date goes over a year end, and if possible. Submitter, will do my best, sir. I mean,
it is absolutely
that's not against the law to screw all of those municipal bond holders, which are, of course, all of these towns and cities and pension funds, etc., around the country. It's unbelievable.
I mean, it's not the first time that it happened in the subprime crisis when they produce all this toxic paper, which is rated AAA. A lot of counties also in the United States, regional authorities in the United Kingdom, had invested the money and lost everything. So it is just, there's also an issue, as you say, of protecting consumers. I think the problem is that in the United Kingdom, it's in some ways worse than the United States because the powers to pursue these cases in the courts is apparently much less. What I don't understand is that if they don't have a law, why don't they pass a law to prosecute these cases? Because they say that LIBOR is outside the ability of the regulatory authorities or the courts to prosecute. They say, well, then you have to change the laws. I mean, there's this sense of paralysis that you cannot do what is necessary because people are just paralyzed by the power these institutions have. But they, in fact, only have power because we allow them to have it. So it's about time we put the rug under their base. You know, I could understand that the bankers were powerful when they were successful. The problem is that now, when they are doing so much damage to the economy, they're still powerful. And that is an incredible paradox. And that really requires you know, good investigative journalism like your own, and a lot of pressure from citizens to change this.
Well, Stephanie Griffith-Jones, just to give you an idea of how the corruption is shared across this side of the Atlantic, during the financial crisis, when Secretary of Treasury Paulson was down on his knees begging Nancy Pelosi for the TARP money, the minority chair who was in on these private high-level meetings, Spencer Baucus, a Republican from Alabama, he was trading off insider information that he got. Then 60 Minutes broke the story about Spencer Baucus and these other congressmen being able to trade off inside information, and they eventually were shamed into passing the Stock Act, which stopped that. But in the meantime, the city of Birmingham, Alabama, that Spencer Baucus represents, that's his district, has gone into bankruptcy because of bad deals that it made with Wall Street. And Spencer Baucus, exactly, believe it or not, got reelected. So go figure.
I know. So the banker gets the bonuses, the politician gets re-elected, and I'm sure lots of people lost their jobs because the local authority went bankrupt, and lots of important social services would have been lost. So this is completely unacceptable. I remember hearing, I don't know if it's true, that when the Dodd-Frank bill was being passed, which is overall a very good bill, that some congressmen were passing amendments, and they came, because they hadn't bothered to retype them, they came on paper from the major American banks. So there was, it was that crude. They didn't even bother to change the paper on which these amendments were written by the banks themselves to try and water down good regulation. So I think, you know, there has to be a major change in the way the system is regulated. It's also not acceptable. How come that the FSA and others only discovered this 3 years after it finished? I mean, it's been going on from 2005 to 2009, and they only now discover it. I mean, that is just amazing to me. Where were these regulators? Were they asleep at the wheel, or, you know, what were they doing?
Particularly after the 2008 crash, you'd think that there'd be a little more attention paid. It does feel, though, that there's, in a broader context, Stephanie Griffith-Jones, has been an attack, as we know here in the United States, a political attack by the Republicans on public employees, starting with the governor of Wisconsin. They're trying to break the public employees' unions as a way to defund the Democratic Party. And this seems to be an adjunct to it by going after the municipalities themselves and bankrupting them or looting them, as apparently these Wall Street traders see this as just, you know, stealing candy from a blind man.
Well, this is similar to what's happening, of course, in Europe, where governments are being forced by the financial markets to impose austerity. And luckily, this has begun to change, because with the triumph of Hollande, there is a change towards some greater emphasis on growth, because you cannot just keep firing workers, reducing social services, cutting back on hospital staff and education establishments, just so that you can make sure that the economy is run in such a way that the bankers can continue profiting. And so, therefore, I think even the conservative government in the UK is talking about the need to restructure the economy. They haven't done too much about it. But, you know, if countries like the United Kingdom and the United States want to compete in the world economy, and this is difficult because it will be challenged by very efficient countries that are emerging, like India, China, Brazil, they need a functional financial system. Not one that is corrupt, that is focused on short-term profits, but one that helps them produce, you know, good products. And if the private sector can't do it, a lot of people in Europe are beginning to talk that the public banks run in the public interest, should play a bigger role, because if the bankers are not willing to accept the kind of regulation that would make the banks work effectively and in an honest way, then maybe we have to think about other options. And you know, maybe Royal Bank of Scotland should stay in public hands, but be run for the public interest, which it isn't at the moment.
Well, Stephanie Griffith-Jones, I thank you so much for joining us here from London.
Real pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephanie Griffith-Jones, who is the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University. She, along with Jose Antonio Campo and Joseph Stiglitz, co-edited Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 Financial Crisis. We're going to take a brief station break, and we will be back in a moment and go to Mexico City.
After all these implements and texts designed by intellects so vexed to find, evidently there's still so much that hides. And though the saints of us divine in ancient feeding lines, their sentiment is just as hard to pluck from the vine.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Oaxaca, Mexico, is Fabienne Tepper, who is an independent journalist and editor of The Sentient Cincinnati. She was a 2011 fellow at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies and a 2012 resident writer at the Mesa Refuge. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fabienne Tepper.
Thanks for having me.
And you've been witnessing the Mexican election yesterday from a different perspective, in as much as most of the reporting was done in Mexico City. You're in Oaxaca, and I take it that the day began rather tempestuously when the students and workers, most of whom would vote for the PRD, for López Obrador, showed up at 9 a.m. at their polling places, and there were no ballots. That's the beginning of the story?
Exactly. Yeah, there are five casillas especiales, which are voting booths specifically for non-resident voters, which is anybody who is registered elsewhere, primarily students and migrant workers. So these folks could begin voting at 8 o'clock, and the majority of people I spoke to said they showed up around 9 to find that there were no more ballots left for them. And when I came into the Zocalo, which is Oaxaca Central Square, at noon, these people were streaming in to lodge official complaints with CEPADE, which is the government body that gathers reports of election fraud and supposedly investigates them.
So what transpired then when they confronted the government officials about the fact that they couldn't get ballots to vote?
Well, for a few hours, people were gathering signatures, and the more people gathered and the more they realized that they were not going to find anybody to speak to, no one was going to produce any extra ballots, and they weren't going to be able to vote that day, they became pretty angry. There's a lot of unrest, and certain people who I think were probably social activists from the local teachers union, who are very active and strong here and have been protesting a lot since the Oaxaca uprising in 2006, people gathered around others. Folks started to give speeches and actually took over the booth of CEPADE, the voter fraud.
The government watchdog, right, yeah.
Right, pardon me. So after a few hours of this, of trying to gather signatures and not really having any good answer, because what these people were experiencing seemed to be a bureaucratic problem, which is that there were just not anywhere near enough ballots for them. To give you numbers, there are 750 ballots available at each polling place, and there are five polling places available to anybody who's a non-resident voter in Oaxaca. So that's 4,250, I think, which is far fewer than the number of people who needed to vote in those places. So after a few hours of this, one of the functionaries of this agency tried to take off and run across the square, at which point the mob who had gathered, at least a few hundred people, took off after him, grabbed him, tore his election official shirt off, and tried to drag him back to the booth he had been manning, gathering complaints. At that point, he managed to get away, ran into a restaurant, and the wait staff of the restaurant wouldn't let anyone inside. And at that point, a lot of different police and military units appeared on the scene. There were members of police forces that I hadn't seen before who had full masks on. They seemed to be members of some kind of elite unit. And the hundreds of people who gathered at that point, there was a lot of press and a lot of speeches, actually chased those policemen off of the square, which seems extraordinary, but it was reminiscent from what happened in 2006 in Oaxaca, when the governor ordered a tear bombing of a few dozens of thousands of teachers who were striking on the streets in Oaxaca, and the teachers started picking up the tear bomb grenades and lobbing them back at the police, which was an event that has galvanized a lot of, I would say, political empowerment in this city.
Right, and that was that's a pre-governor, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Right, pre-governor of the state of Oaxaca, and the teachers' union, of course, would be they'd want to vote for PRD, most likely the supporters of AMLO, López Obrador. I believe an American freelance journalist was killed at that point too. But anyway, let's continue with your story about what happened yesterday in Oaxaca, in the Zocalo.
Sure. Well, there was a great deal of talk about fraud. People felt that they had been, unfairly denied their right to vote because they had no more recourse. So from what I can gather, having spoken to the election officials today, I don't know that it was fraud. The fact that these people were not able to vote, it seemed to be a bureaucratic problem, as I said. But the anger that swelled, the number of people that were thronging into Oaxaca's central square, they were talking about more than that. They seemed to have a very strong sense, because the international press was already reporting that the election had been calm and that it would easily go to Enrique Peña Nieto, of the same party which had been governing for many years and which had been broadly considered corrupt and and which has been accused of buying a lot of votes in this recent election. The Guardian did a series of exposés, which I think you already spoke about in your last show.
Yes, indeed. And yesterday there were complaints that the were offering 9,500 prepaid gift cards to incentivize people to vote for them. Great. That's probably the tip of an iceberg. So tell me about, though, why it is that a town with a substantial student population wouldn't have ballots for the students.
That's a good question. I asked an election official that a couple hours ago, and he simply pled the law. He said that the law does not allow them to have any more than 750 ballots at every polling place.
But they clearly didn't have enough polling places.
They didn't, no. They had 5 polling places for this whole group of people. So I'm not sure why that's happened or if it's clear which political party would be benefited by that. It does seem that migrant workers and students, at least in this region, seem to overwhelmingly vote for Obrador, as the city of Oaxaca and the region, their votes went very clearly towards him. But officials haven't given much of an explanation as to why they don't offer more polling places.
So, again, I'm speaking with Fabienne Tepper, who's in Oaxaca, Mexico. She's an independent journalist and editor of Sentient Cincinnati. She was a 2011 fellow at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies and a 2012 resident writer at the Mesa Refuge. So put this in the context of other complaints throughout Mexico. Obviously, as we all know, most of the coverage was focused on Mexico City. And, it's useful to talk to somebody that wasn't actually in Mexico City. And I'm just wondering how much what you witnessed yesterday in terms of this riot by people who were denied the vote was a nationwide phenomenon.
Well, from what I can gather from local news reports, many papers, of course, have allegedly been bought out by the PRI party. But there were protests in other cities. There were protests by people in the same situation as those in Oaxaca who had been denied a ballot because there weren't any left for non-resident voters. I saw some photographs of protests in Mexico City and other cities, but perhaps the significance of what happened in Oaxaca is that Oaxaca is a city where there's a pretty strong loyalty to Obrador's party. There have been massive rallies where you haven't even been able to move through the central square over the last 2 weeks. And just judging by the signs people have in their shop windows, there's a great deal of solidarity on behalf of this other party. So the lack of coverage here probably fails to show the effect on the vote, on a large segment of the vote that would not have gone for Nieto.
Sure, and it's a bit hard to get your head around the idea that you have such popularity for the PRD in the state of Oaxaca, and yet you have a pre-governor. do you have any answer to that mystery?
No, I don't. I'm afraid I don't have an answer to that mystery.
Right.
Although there were some other interesting things that happened yesterday, and it was hard as an outsider to know, where orders were coming from or how all of these different military and police units arrived, but at one point, I saw a huge paddy wagon pull up to the square right around when helicopters started circling over. And I started filming, and it was unloading state police, which I assume, you know, had come to respond to the protest in some way. But I soon noticed that they were all pulling tubas, trumpets, and a variety of wind instruments out of the paddy wagon with them, and they immediately struck up a police orchestra at the opposite end of the square from where Yo Soy 132 was denouncing election fraud. So I could not tell whether that was a pre-planned concert or if it was a nonviolent diversionary tactic by the state police force, but it was very effective. And once they started playing, they fully drowned out the speeches going on at the opposite corner of the square, and they took away a lot of their audience as well, just police orchestra.
From the students, Yosoi 132 movement.
Exactly.
Well, I thank you for joining us. A very colorful description of something that doesn't sound entirely kosher, but then the history of Mexican political elections has been pretty brazenly fraudulent. And I think that what happened in this election was more to do with not so much fraud, but vote buying.
Right.
But you've given us an account of what would, I think, pass as serious irregularities. I thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Fabian Tepper, who is in Oaxaca, Mexico. She's an independent journalist and editor of The Sentient Cincinnati. She was a 2011 fellow at the Point Institute for Media Studies and a 2012 resident writer at the Mesa Refuge. Let's now turn to Dr. Pamela Starr, who is in Mexico City. She is the director of the U.S.-Mexico Network at the University of Southern California, where she researches contemporary Mexico, its politics and policymaking, foreign policy and relations with the United States, and the politics of economic policymaking across Latin America. She spent 8 years in Mexico as a professor of Latin American political economy at the Instituto Tecnológico Autónomo de México, ITAM, and recently published an article at foreignaffairs.com, What Mexico's Election Means for the Drug War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Pamela Starr.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And you've obviously been busy over the last 2 days. Is there any final resolution in as much as López Obrador AMLO, as far at least as up until recently, had not conceded, when it's pretty clear that Peña Nieto has won the presidential elections?
Yeah, let me, before we get to that, just make a clarification. The current governor of Oaxaca is currently from a coalition of the PRD and the FUN.
Oh, he is? Okay.
They actually were able last year to finally dislodge the PRI from the governorship.
So okay. Okay. Well, thank you for that correction.
For the listeners.
Yeah.
In terms of sort of López Obrador, he has not recognized the results of the election as announced by the Federal Electoral Commission. And indeed, just a few hours ago, he announced that he was going to challenge the results of the election. And it actually makes a great deal of sense that he has made that decision. As your previous guest noted, and as I noticed yesterday as I was wandering around playing Electoral Observer, there were a lot of irregularities in the voting process. There were a lot of there's a lot of unusual activity in voting stations throughout the state of Mexico, which is a stronghold of the PRI. And there very clearly were irregularities in the campaign in terms of spending money, in terms of the bias of the media. So it's worthwhile for the PRD to challenge these results. And additionally, it's what López Obrador's supporters are demanding. I am 132. The student movement has been marching out in front of my hotel. I went down and watched them about a half an hour ago walk by. And they're just adamant that this election campaign was unfair. And I don't think they would accept anything less from López Obrador than him at least challenging the results before the Federal Electoral Tribunal. And finally, this is what he personally thinks is right. He thinks that the campaign was unfair, and that it's his responsibility for Mexican democracy to challenge what he thinks is an unfair outcome.
So on top of the flagrant bias of the media duopolies, Azteca and Televisa, who effectively anointed Peña Nieto months ago as the next president of Mexico, and the lot of evidence of vote buying, on top of that, now we have a lot of evidence of electoral fraud.
It's call it electoral fraud. I mean, there is evidence of electoral fraud. The thing that's different now is that Benin Yepo has completely restructured the way the pre-machine works. He's made it a machine that we would recognize in the United States as a traditional Democratic Party machine, like the old Chicago machine or the old Tammany House machine, and made it for the 21st century. So you don't see fraud when you go to voting stations in Mexico State and other places where the pre is dominant. What happens is you actually have a government that delivers to the people and encourages the people after the fact, because they have received a tractor or they have received a job or they have received a new road, they aggressively encourage them to vote for the party. And they have lists to keep track of how people vote to make sure they do vote for the party, and they bust them in. So it's not like the old days where people actually were paid for their votes. There's still some of that going on, but it is more of what I would call a real powerful democratic political machine. I mean, it's a machine designed to work in a democratic context.
So given then that there is this electoral body that AMLO can appeal to, I'm surprised at the ease and with which the global press, the American press, have accepted Peña Nieto as the new leader, unquestioningly.
We're talking about 4 million votes. That's the difference between Peña Nieto and López Obrador. The likelihood that there's that much fraud in an election that was extremely well, if not completely covered by electoral observers, in which virtually every polling station had representatives from all three parties. Finding fraud in the ballots, 4 million worth, is highly, highly unlikely. Mm-hmm. What this says to me is what López Obrador is going to do is accept the outcome of the election. He will say it's illegitimate because of fraud, of vote buying, of inequality in the campaign. But at the end of the day, he is going to accept this result. We're not going to get a repeat of 6 years ago when he lost by 250,000 votes, that he went out on the streets with his people and occupied the center of Mexico City for several months. That's not going to happen again. And I think he's saying that he's going through the political institutions, challenging it before the Electoral Tribunal, is basically saying to us that at the end of the day, they're going to accept the outcome.
So what then will obviously he's not you're saying he's not going to relitigate it, and he did when it was so close, 250,000. Now there's a distance of 4 million. It's unlikely that he has a case. But what about the student movement that has gained so much attention in this election? Is that going to live on?
That's a big question mark. We can only hope that they'll live on. I mean, for me, there are two really huge silver linings in this election. One is the fact that even though the PRI is coming back to power, they did not get a majority in the national legislature, in the Congress. In fact, the Congress is pretty much divided, looks like it's going to be divided into threes between the three main parties, although the PRI has a larger group. That means that Peña Nieto, at least at the national level, the PRI is going to have to learn how to govern democratically. And that's a very positive thing for the development of democracy in Mexico over the long term. But the other thing is the anger that we see in the student movement toward the manipulation of the media and the sense that Peña Nieto was imposed by the media gives the progressive movement, the pro-human rights, pro-civil rights, pro-democracy movements in Mexico a target. They're mad. I've been watching blogs all day, watching the anger that these groups are feeling, and they're targeting their anger on this government. If this mobilizes a civil society in a country that has found it very difficult to get civil society to play its appropriate role in the democratic process, that's another very positive thing. Will they be able to do it? I'm not sure. They don't have a clear leader like the Chilean student movement, but let's hope they do.
Well, there have been analogies made with Yosoy 132 and the Arab Spring, and I suspect that the Mexican student movement is largely a middle-class movement and not as broad as the Arab Spring movement. But what they do seem to have in common is this repulsion about a small group of oligarchs plundering the country, and no other country has a more flagrant history of oligarchy, and this is the pre-party is the power. Has always been the representative of the oligarchs. After all, Mexico has Carlos Slim Alou, one of the richest men in the world, and yet it has one-third to one-half of its people in poverty. Some of them, I think about a third, in pretty severe poverty. So there's obviously a lot of injustice and a lot of indignation that's totally appropriate.
Absolutely. And don't underestimate the size of the Mexican middle class. And Mexico has a lot of poor people. They have a lot of lower middle class people and middle class people. It's a country of 110 million. And what's really encouraging about watching the student movement and watching the students march by my hotel half an hour ago is that you see that these are students from the upper class, the upper middle class, the middle class, the lower middle class, and the upper lower class. They're running the gambit of Mexican society. They're just students, is what they share in common. And they're working together toward a common goal, which is to improve the quality of Mexican democracy and to try to do exactly what you're saying, is to create an environment in which the wealth is distributed more equally in this country.
So just in the last minute then, Dr. Pamela Starr, did this election... the turnout wasn't as big as I believe last time, and that
actually was bigger.
Was it bigger? Oh, so that was initial reports were.
It's the largest in history, which is another very good sign.
And in terms of the results, then this is not so much a victory for the PRI as a kind of repudiation of the PAN. My understanding is that 12-year interregnum between the two. PRIs, the 71-year rule and the new rule, is largely about the fact that the PAN failed, right?
Yeah. I keep describing the PRI victory as Mexicans voting for safe change, in the sense that the majority of Mexicans simply had had it with the bond. They'd had 12 years of a stagnant economy and 6 years of a worsening security situation. And whatever the extenuating circumstances were, the voters just didn't care. And many voters, because of what happened in 2006 with the PRD occupying downtown Mexico City, they were afraid, many of them, to turn to the PRD. They just felt that maybe López Obrador was too radical. So they held their nose, they voted for the PRI, and then legislative elections, a lot of them voted for a separate party and denied the PRI a majority. So it is a punishment against the PAN, but it's also a statement on the fact that the population isn't real happy with any of their political parties right now.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us from Mexico City, Pamela Starr.
It's a pleasure, and thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Pamela Starr, who's the director of the U.S.-Mexico Network at the University of Southern California. She was an official election observer for the elections in Mexico and has an article at foreignaffairs.com, What Mexico Election Means for the Drug War. This has been a Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Christian Vasquez. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.